Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Preconceived. Last week's episode was called Sick Boy with Jeremy Saunders, and there's a part two to that episode, which I had been planning on releasing this week. But given the recent situation escalating in the Middle East with Iran, I recorded this episode this week. I'm recording this on Friday, April the 19th, and I thought this would be a more relevant episode to publish this week. So I'm just putting that there as a disclaimer in case you're wondering where's part two to last week's episode, Sick Boy. And that episode with Jeremy Saunders will be published next week, which is titled 30 Years to Live. So I'm really excited about that episode, but I'm also really excited to share with you this episode that is hot off the press, discussing the situation that is developing in Iran. So I hope you enjoy, and for part two of last week's episode, you'll have to wait one more week. And here's another episode of
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Conceived. You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. On April 13th, Iran launched over 300 missiles and drones over Israel. While Israel's Iron Dome and missile defensive system was able to mitigate almost all of the damage, the attack itself was unprecedented and a frightening development to the international community. When most of us think of modern-day Iran, we think of an oppressive authoritarian regime that suppresses the rights of its people and also deeply hates the West. But how did this situation come to be? Why does Iran hate the West so fiercely? What does Iran want? And how seriously must the Iranian problem be taken? There have been concerns over their nuclear weapons program for many years, and now that Iran has launched an attack, how is the world supposed to respond? Before I bring in today's guest, I want to share a very, very brief history of modern Iran to give a little bit of context to the Iran that we know today. Iran was initially known as Persia and is one of the oldest countries in the world, dating back thousands of years. But if we look back to the 20th century, the Qajar dynasty fell in the early 1920s, and then there was the emergence of the Pahlavi dynasty. The Pahlavi dynasty was started by Reza Shah, and then his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who's just better known as the Shah, took over from him. The Pahlavi dynasty and the Shah had control over Iran from the 1920s all the way until 1979. The Shah was considered to be quite authoritarian, but also did seek to westernize the country. In 1979 came the Iranian Revolution. With this Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the fall of the Shah came the ascendance of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was established then and maintains power until this day. In contrast to the previous decades under the Shah, the Islamic Republic of Iran is fiercely anti-West. Anyhow, that's just a very brief introduction of some of the Iranian history over the past 100 years, but this Islamic Republic of Iran was established in 1979 as part of the Iranian Revolution and reigns till this day. And that's the authoritarian regime that we're still talking about today that hates the West and that recently launched this attack on Israel. Anyhow, that's just a brief introduction so we can give a little more context to the conversation that I'm having with one of the world's leading experts on Iran, Mark Dubowitz. Mark is the chief executive of Foundation for Defense of Democracies, better known as FDD, a Washington, D.C.-based nonpartisan policy institute. Mark is an expert on Iran's nuclear program and global threat network and is widely recognized as one of the key influencers in shaping policies to counter the threats from the regime of Iran. He also contributes to FDD's China program, drawing on his academic background in China studies and his private sector work in the Indo-Pacific. In 2019, Iran sanctioned Mark and FDD, calling them, quote, the designing and executing arm of the U.S. administration on Iran policy. These threats led to bipartisan condemnation, including from Trump, Obama, Bush, and Clinton administration officials. In 2022, the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC accused Mark and FDD of playing, quote, a key role in organizing the rebellions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. That same year, Russia sanctioned Mark among other prominent national security and business professionals in response to American efforts to hold Moscow accountable for its war in Ukraine. Mark has long exposed the malign ties between the regimes in Russia and Iran and advocated for sanctions in Russia. According to the New York Times, quote, Mark Dubowitz's campaign to draw attention to what he saw as the flaws in the Iran nuclear deal has taken its place among the most consequential ever undertaken by a Washington think tank leader. According to The Atlantic, quote, Dubowitz has been helping design and push forward sanctions on Iran. Establishing the FDD as DC's ground zero for research and policy recommendations aimed at highlighting and fixing what Dubowitz saw as the flaws in the nuclear agreement. According to a former U.S. administration official, quote, if you want to know what's going to happen next in Iran policy, there's a pretty good bet that it's whatever has been in the latest Mark Dubowitz or FDD op-ed. Mark has advised the Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and testified more than 20 times before the U.S. Congress and foreign legislatures. He is the author or co-author of dozens of studies on economic sanctions and Iran's nuclear program and is widely published and cited in U.S. and international media. All right, Mark Dubowitz, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Zale.
You are the guy to be speaking to about Iran in general and what's going on, and really a pleasure. I know you've been really busy on the news circuit and in important meetings with people who are actually trying to figure out what to do next, so really appreciate you taking the time.
I look forward to the conversation.
So I just gave a little bit of a brief history of modern Iran, very brief, very elementary for somebody who actually knows the history of Iran, but basically just describing how the Iranian Revolution came to be in 1979, and that coincided with the fall of the Shah, and the Islamic Republic of Iran was established at that point. Obviously, there's a lot going on in the world, and I'm tempted to just get straight to the meat of it, but I'm going to deter that hesitation because I think the context here is really important for a lot of the listeners here who might not know much about the Iranian situation and what the concern has been with Iran over the past many decades, really. I just spoke about in the introduction how Iran is known to be an authoritarian regime. What is the state of life like generally in Iran? When I say authoritarian, that's a word that can be interpreted in many ways. Life for the Iranian people is not great under this regime. Is that accurate to say?
It's certainly, it's miserable. It's miserable in terms of the economy, in terms of the politics, their quality of life, clearly their complete lack of freedom. I mean, the problem with Iran is that you've got this really incredibly dynamic population, very well educated. I mean, actually, since the Islamic Revolution, probably the only good thing that the mullahs have done is set up a system of universities, which are quite good. And so you've got this generation or generations of Iranians who've graduated from these universities. It's a very young generation. The majority of the population under the age of 35 graduate with, you know, advanced degrees into an economy that is incapable of delivering jobs. And in fact, if you want any more evidence of that, I mean, Zale, you're from Toronto. I grew up in Toronto. It's affectionately known as Tehranto because there are a lot of Iranians in Toronto, and they've done incredibly well. They're amazing immigrants. They come, they're very successful, they're very well educated, many of them doctors and dentists, many of them in business. And that's true all over the world. I mean, look in California, look in Europe, Australia. The only place where Iranians are not successful is in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that is the result of over four decades of not just brutal repression, but an economy that is just absolutely incapable of delivering a high quality of life to Iranians, despite the fact that Iran has the second largest oil reserves in the world, I believe, and the fourth largest natural gas reserves in the world. I mean, it's an economy that should be doing very well, given its wealth and given the the abilities of its people, and yet life is pretty miserable there.
Why is the economy not doing well when they've got the resources, they've got intelligent, educated people? Does it just come down to the leadership?
Well, it's a command economy. I mean, it's a government-controlled economy, and it's typical for these sort of authoritarian regimes that don't have any sort of semblance of a real free market. There's tremendous corruption, and you've got the most of the wealth accruing to a very small group of well-connected insiders, and the rest of the Iranian population is barely getting by on subsistence wages. So it's a result both of the nature of the economy, but also this is a country that has been under punishing international sanctions for decades as a result of the regime's illicit activities, their nuclear weapons program in particular, but their regional aggression, their domestic repression, their missile program. And as a result, those sanctions have exacerbated the already weak economy. And so today, we can go over the various metrics of the economy, but it's pretty striking how bad the economy has been performing. Though recently under President Biden over the past couple of years, it sort of was on its back under Trump, and it's getting up on its knees under Biden as a result of the sanctions relief that President Biden has provided to the regime, both in terms of access to billions of dollars of frozen oil revenues and the lack of enforcement of oil sanctions. But there's a lot to talk about on that front.
People who don't know much about Iran probably do know enough that Iran really is known for hating the West. And I had a guest on recently, ironically enough, just a couple months ago about North Korea, where we had a whole conversation and I was saying, kind of, what's the deal with North Korea? Because we look at North Korea and we think it's nuts. And he said, that's what I want to challenge. To us, it's nuts, but to them, it's coldly rational. To them, they have an understanding of why they're doing what they do. That doesn't mean it's not heinous. It doesn't mean that what they're doing, their policies, their ideologies are scary. But I'm curious if you were to ask somebody in Iran why they hate the West, what their answer would be. Because while it seems irrational to us, sometimes the best way to understand kind of the enemy, so to speak, is to understand what their perspective is. So I'm curious what their perspective would be as to why they are so anti-American, anti-Israel, and anti-everything Western.
Actually, I think if you ask the average Iranian, the majority would tell you they love the West. They love America. They have no problems with Israel. I mean, the majority of Iranians are anti-regime, and we can talk about, the wave of protests that have erupted in Iran over the past 15 years. But I guess the question is, if you asked a member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, if you asked members of the clerical establishment, or if you asked the Supreme Leader himself, why do you hate the West? That's probably the question that you're asking me. And I think it's deeply ideological. It's deeply theological. I mean, I think the big mistake we make is, as Westerners, we mirror imaging. We mirror image, I think, on our adversary. And we assume we have the same values, the same principles, the same ambitions, the same objectives. We want to live a good life. We want to give a good life to our kids. And, we ultimately, as Westerners, we value materialism over ideas in many respects. Well, we, as a result, we're always incapable of recognizing and appreciating the ideas of our adversaries. And the Islamic Revolution brought in a whole set of ideas after the Shah that really were not only to challenge the West, but that it was a revolution. It was a revolution, and it was one motivated by revolutionary ideas. And these are men, mostly men, who believe that they have a global mission to bring Islam to the world, to bring their brand of Islam to the world, Shiite Islam. And this is very much behind their regional aggression, which is to really inculcate those ideas amongst Arabs in the Middle East, where Shiites are the minority, Sunnis are the majority. But it's also a global mission, which is why they're all over Africa and Latin America and Asia, while they're opening up schools and madrasas and cultural centers, including in Toronto, to bring this mission, this set of ideas to the world. So very much motivated. Unlike North Korea, by the way, you brought up North Korea. It's sort of interesting. I mean, North Korea's got this sort of Stalinist ideology, right? A totalitarian regime without really any regional ambitions, without any global ambitions. I mean, I don't think the North Koreans have any interest in expanding their ideological views outside of the Korean Peninsula. They certainly want to take over South Korea. But beyond that, there doesn't seem to be the same kind of revolutionary spirit that motivates the Kim family. But Khamenei and his predecessor, Khomeini, are very much men of faith, men of ideas. And they, for them, the West represents the antithesis of everything they hold dear. In fact, America is the great Satan. You know, Israel is the little Satan whispering in the ear of the great Satan, which is kind of plays into their anti-Semitic conspiratorial theories about the power of Jews. But for them, really, it's America and it's the West and it's the toxic touch of the secular materialistic West, which, by the way, they blame for having transformed their women into women who refuse to wear hijabs, you know, who flout their beauty and their ambitions. And for them, this is the absolute threat to the Islamic Republic, which is why they've cracked down so hard on Iranian women who seek to be free.
That's a really articulate explanation and just gives insight into kind of what is in the mindset of the, and I like how you distinguish there, not the people of Iran, but the leaders of Iran who are making some of these decisions. And we often do tend to look at things from our own lens naturally, but especially in these types of situations where we're looking at countries and peoples who are growing up in a different context, it's important to look at it in a different way. One of the reasons the concern about Iran has been so grave over the past couple decades is because of this threat of nuclear weapons, nuclear concerns. When did this develop, as far as we know? When did Iran start having these nuclear ambitions? And when did their program, as far as we know, because I don't even know if we do know the full history of when they started it, when did that begin?
So, I mean, Iran received its first sort of research reactor, nuclear reactor, I believe it was called the Peace for Atoms program. And this was under the Shah. This was a research reactor that, you know, was supposed to be used for medical and scientific research. But it was really after the Islamic Revolution, particularly as you sort of started to move into the 1990s and 2000s. It was after Iran had fought the brutal war with Iraq that ended in 1988, that the Islamic Republic began to believe that having nuclear weapons capability was essential to not only its security, but its power projection in the region and the survival of the regime and the Islamic Republic itself. So this really became more of an acute crisis in the early 2000s as the regime began to expand that capability, as Western intelligence agencies discovered clandestine nuclear programs and infrastructure. And, you know, it's gone through fits and starts, but the regime has been very skillful at expanding this nuclear weapons program under the guise of a, quote, civilian program, a dual-use program. And we can go into the details, but, you know, fast forward to 2024, and today Iran has a significant nuclear infrastructure. They have the ability to enrich uranium to weapons grade levels, probably one bomb's worth in 7 days, maybe 12 in about 5 months. So they've really perfected the enrichment process, which is the key fissile material you need for a nuclear weapon. They have the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. So they have the ability to have a long-range ballistic missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. And what's left, sort of the third element or the third leg of the stool, is the nuclear warhead. And they haven't finished the warhead. The U.S. intelligence community, since 2007, the consensus view is that Iran hasn't begun work on weaponization, that the Supreme Leader hasn't directed his nuclear scientists to begin this work, and that that work actually stopped in 2003 after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when the Iranians saw how quickly the U.S. military dealt with the Iraqi military. Again, a military it had fought to a standstill in a brutal 8-year war during the Iran-Iraq war. Here was the U.S. military in 100 days, basically demolishing Saddam and his military. Iranians decided to stop their formal weaponization program, and it went basically covert with a covert element of it and an overt element of it. The overt element of it is the enrichment and the plutonium reprocessing for, quote, civilian purposes. The covert element of it was keeping this brain trust of nuclear scientists under the leadership of a guy named Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who were available and ready to begin restart work on weaponization. By the way, Israel's Mossad killed Fakhrizadeh, who's really considered to be the Oppenheimer of Iran's nuclear weapons program. But yet there's still a couple of dozen very talented nuclear weapons scientists in Iran. And just to finish the story, we believe now, contrary to that U.S. intelligence community's consensus view, which has been the view for 17 years, that Iran has actually begun work on its weaponization program. Preliminary work, computer modeling, starting to test some of the elements of what it would take to build a warhead. Again, with a sort of conventional excuse that this work is really about conventional explosives and other conventional R&D, and this is not about weaponization. So that's very much the hallmark of Iran's nuclear weapons program. Move ahead forward, always have an excuse for why you're doing it under civilian cover. And we are today in a place where they are really a turn of a screw away from having nuclear weapons.
So that's pretty scary, some of the numbers you gave there. Come to 2015, there's this Iran nuclear agreement, and you were an opponent of the agreement when Obama was working on this, and it did come to fruition, and then eventually it was dismantled by Trump. Walk me a little bit through what this deal was in 2015, why you opposed it, and then why ultimately you didn't feel it was a good idea, even though you had opposed it, that Trump dismantled it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long and windy, complex story. I'll try to shorten it. I mean, basically, Obama comes into office in 2009, and at the time, there are mass protests break out shortly after he takes office, called the Green Revolution, where millions of Iranians are on the streets yelling, "Death to the dictator, President Obama, are you with us? Are you with the dictator?" Obama decides to engage with the Islamic Republic. Essentially choose engagement with the Ayatollah over support for the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution gets crushed by the regime. And for the next few years, the US Congress, deeply concerned about both the internal repression and Iran's expanding nuclear program, starts to impose significant sanctions on the regime, often over the objections of the Obama administration, which was sort of comfortable doing small, performative, symbolic sanctions. But Congress was really taking the lead in punishing economic sanctions, focused on the oil sector, the financial sector, automotive, mining. I mean, the key, pillars of Iran's economy were now being targeted by these congressional sanctions. Anyway, they passed with overwhelming majorities over the objections of President Obama, who then veto-proof majorities had to sign it into law. So the Iranian economy begins to suffer significantly. And in 2013, the Obama administration, Jake Sullivan, who at the time was working for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Bill Burns, who was a senior State Department official, they go to Oman and begin back-channel negotiations with the Iranians. That ends up in a deal called the Joint Plan of Action, or the JPOA. It's sort of an interim agreement. And the idea is to sort of trade away some sanctions relief, get some interim nuclear concessions just to pause the program or slow it down, and then give the time to negotiate a more comprehensive agreement, which they finally do in 2015. And that culminates in the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Obama administration sort of sells the deal to Congress as, "We have now cut off all, permanently cut off all pathways to Iranian nuclear weapons." And, big debate takes place in Congress, hearings, and ultimately votes. And the opposition to the deal, so those like me, are very concerned that the deal does not permanently close pathways to Iranian nuclear weapons, because written into the deal are these sunset provisions, where key restrictions on Iran's nuclear weapons program go away over time. So ultimately, the key restrictions on enrichment, on the use of and testing of advanced centrifuges, the accumulation of enriched uranium, the enrichment to higher and higher and more dangerous levels of uranium, the ability of Iran ultimately to break free of all these restrictions and build an unlimited nuclear infrastructure with multiple enrichment facilities and plutonium reactors, to be able to enrich to 60% enriched uranium, maybe even to 90%. There's sort of no prohibition from Iran to go to the ultimate level of weapons-grade uranium. Those all disappear in 2030. In addition, the deal requires that the UN arms embargo on Iran expire in 2020, the missile embargo expire in 2023, and all the other UN Security Council resolutions that the Bush administration and actually the Obama administration had patiently and I think quite wisely negotiated, particularly the ones that ban Iranian enrichment, those all go away. And so what we're effectively saying to the Iranians is you have a patient pathway to nuclear weapons, and we'll give you unlimited sanctions relief. I mean, we had estimated over $1 trillion of sanctions relief. So leaving Iran into the late 2020s, 2030, with a industrial-sized nuclear program, near zero nuclear breakout, a much easier clandestine sneak out as it can install much more efficient, high-powered advanced centrifuges, which are, because they're much more efficient, you need smaller numbers, they're therefore easier to hide. A missile program, which the JCPOA doesn't even address, and a fortified economy, increasingly immunized against the ability of America and Europe to use sanctions because of the $1 trillion plus in sanctions relief. So you get a much more dangerous Iran with a much more dangerous nuclear program, but you're essentially doing the classic Washington game, which is you're kicking a can down the road. And, you know, sort of increasing the odds that Iran won't get a nuclear weapon on Obama's watch. But as we learned from North Korea, that game of kicking the can down the road just essentially means you're not kicking the can, but you're kicking a hand grenade down the road. And then it ends up landing in the lap of the next president and blows up. And that's the North Korea nuclear experience. So I opposed the deal, and it was opposed by almost all Republicans, many Democrats, opposed by the Israelis, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, but it was concluded and it went into effect in 2016. Donald Trump comes into office, immediately says this is the worst deal ever negotiated. Takes a couple of years, but by May 2018, Trump says, I'm out of here, and he withdraws from the agreement. Now, at the time, I thought it was a better idea to stay in the agreement with all of its flaws and reinstate all of the sanctions on non-nuclear grounds. Because as the Obama administration made it clear, both President Obama, John Kerry, his then Secretary of State and lead negotiator, as well as the Secretary of the Treasury and others who testified to Congress in that 2015 time period, there was nothing in the agreement that would prevent the United States from using, quote, non-nuclear sanctions or reinstating non-nuclear sanctions for Iran's other illicit activities relating to terrorism and missile proliferation and arms proliferation and human rights abuses. So my argument to the Trump administration was stay in the deal, reinstate all the sanctions based on non-nuclear grounds, use the mechanisms of the deal to force the Iranians not only to comply with the deal, which I believe they were going to anyway, because why break the deal when they've got this legal patient pathway to ultimately an industrial-sized legal and legitimate nuclear program, but really squeeze the Iranians and let them leave the deal. You know, why isolate the Americans? Isolate the Iranians. I pretty much convinced then National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and I think we were all in agreement that this was the way to go, and we would negotiate this sort of supplemental or side agreement with the Europeans to try to get the Europeans to agree ultimately that this deal needed to be longer and stronger and broader, and that would be a US E3 agreement. Well, Trump then fired McMaster, brought in John Bolton, who thought this was a crazy idea, and Bolton then convinced Pompeo and others. But ultimately, I think all of that might be even a sideshow. The President of the United States was absolutely committed to getting out of this deal. He withdraws from the agreement, as I say, in May 2018. And then, interestingly, the Iranians wait a year till like spring, summer 2019 before they begin to incrementally expand their nuclear program. Then Trump kills Qasem Soleimani. And he's the head of the IRGC Quds Force. He's Iran's most experienced battlefield commander, you know, one of the most experienced and deadly terrorist in the world, and he leads all of Iran's regional activities through their proxies like Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and others. Well, Soleimani goes down. Huge, huge shock to the system. Huge shock to the American system and the Iranian system, because George W. Bush was not prepared to do this. Certainly, Barack Obama wasn't prepared to do this, despite the fact that this terrorist had the blood of thousands of Americans on his hands, Americans who had been killed and maimed in Iraq, particularly, but around the world and certainly in the region, not to mention hundreds of thousands of Middle Easterners, including, you know, 500,000 Syrians who had been slaughtered by Bashar Assad with the assistance of Iran, and on and on and on. So when Trump kills Soleimani, the Iranian regime stops expanding their nuclear program because they don't know what Trump's going to do next. I mean, this crazy president might go after them next.
He's super predictable, though.
Yeah, super predictable, right? Everybody's got him figured out, and they are just kind of befuddled but terrified by this guy. Their response, by the way, is to the killing of Soleimani is limited. They sort of warn the Americans through the Swiss that they're going to be firing missiles at a U.S. base in the Middle East, and there are, you know, there are injuries to U.S. soldiers. One should not minimize that, but the response was fairly limited because, again, they were very afraid that Trump would escalate and that the United States of America would take down the regime. And the only thing that the Islamic Republic fears more than its people is the United States of America doing to Khamenei what the US did to Saddam and Gaddafi and, you know, numerous other dictators around the world. So they wait. They don't escalate their program. Joe Biden then runs against Trump on a platform that maximum pressure, the policy of the Trump administration has failed, and we must turn to a policy of maximum diplomacy. We need to go back into the JCPOA. We need to negotiate with the Iranians. We need to provide them sanctions relief, and then we'll go back into the JCPOA. And then, in an admission of the flaws of the original agreement, they say we need to negotiate a longer, stronger, and broader agreement. Well, 3 years of trying to do that has failed. Iranians have massively escalated their nuclear program, most of that escalation under President Biden, and they've gone, you know, from 3.75% to 20% to 60%. They went up to 84% momentarily on the enrichment side. They've installed, you know, thousands of advanced centrifuges. They're breaking ground on a new, very dangerous enrichment facility at Natanz, where they already have an existing enrichment facility, and on and on. And we can talk about the details of the program. But I mean, the trajectory of this essentially is the fatally flawed JCPOA, which gives Iran patient pathways to nuclear weapons, nuclear legitimacy, and a fortified economy, as well as, you know, a huge amount of money to spend on terrorism and missiles and the like, leads to a Trump withdrawal, which is about a 2-year policy of maximum pressure. That pressure really sinks the Iranian economy. But with the exception of the killing of Soleimani, Trump does not use other instruments of American power to really squeeze the regime. Biden comes in, reverses Trump, and now we're in a policy of maximum deference or maximum concessions 3 years in, a failed policy. Biden administration doesn't have a plan B after their plan A of diplomacy has not worked. And we are where we are. And we've seen the last week of, or certainly the last week, the last 6 months, and even prior to that, of aggression from the regime across multiple lines of malign activity.
Well, that's an incredible summary. I feel bad that I asked you for it because that's a lot of explaining, but really, really gives people an understanding of what's been going on over the last 15, 20 years.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I want to bring it into recent events as you just said, over the past week. So we're recording this on April 19th, and by the time it's posted, who knows what will have changed. Already last night, for us at least, there was a very small counterattack from Israel. What I'm curious is, obviously it's a big deal when you hear that over 300 missiles and drones were fired from Iran to Israel. On the other hand, we hear all the time that there are being missiles that are sent over to Israel from Hezbollah, from Gaza with Hamas there. And what makes this so different? They obviously didn't use any nuclear capabilities here. There's a concern because they could eventually. But what was so different about this attack that had the world completely on edge and captivated for all the wrong reasons?
So it was the first time that Iran had directly attacked Israel from its soil, right? So Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and before him Khomeini, very much had a strategy of using proxies. And you name some of them: Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Houthis, the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria. You know, these are proxies that have been used very effectively by the Islamic Republic over decades to attack, kill, and maim Israelis and Americans and Saudis and others in the region. And they've always been very careful about not directly attacking either the United States or Israel. And so this is sort of use the proxy, you know, have some plausible deniability. And it's kind of, you know, it's this sort of octopus idea that was popularized by former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett of Israel, which is kind of the head of the octopus sits in Tehran, and these poisonous tentacles are unleashed on Iran's enemies. And then the enemies just get trapped fighting the tentacles while the head of the octopus remains immune and free to direct this violence, you know, repress their people, maintain the regime, and advance their nuclear weapons program. So what happened is that all changed last weekend when they fired 321 ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones at Israel. And the warning was, you're worried about a multi-front war? You used to be worried about a multi-front war with, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza. You're worried about the West Bank with Hamas and Islamic Jihad beginning to create enormous problems in the West Bank and terrorism being directed against Israel. You're worried about Hezbollah and militias in Syria, Iraq. Now the Houthis are firing at Israel, southern Israel, targeting Eilat, and also firing at the Red Sea to shut down international shipping. Well, if you like that scenario, how about we up it and amp it, and now you're going to be faced with hundreds of ballistic and cruise missiles and drones coming directly from Iran. And we have, as I said earlier, the largest missile arsenal in the Middle East, and we can rain down thousands of precision-guided ballistic and cruise missiles on your cities at the same time that you're trying to fend off this attack from our proxy. So, you know, game changer, the kind of the shadow war between Iran and Israel that has been going on for decades. We come out of the shadows into the light, and Iran's supreme leader and the IRGC make it clear, we're going to attack you directly, Israel, which is exactly what they did. It failed because of, you know, the technological wizardry of Israeli air defense with a good assist from the US and UK and France and our Arab allies. But that certainly was, you know, what I'd call deterrence by denial. You know, we're going to deter the Iranians by denying them the ability to hurt us when they fire at us. Well, after October 7th, the Israelis have learned deterrence by denial, the idea that you can deter Hamas by denying them massive Israeli casualties by using the Iron Dome air defense system. That entire concept collapsed on October 7th when Hamas broke through that highly sophisticated technological wall, fired, you know, thousands of missiles and rockets at Israel, and then murdered, raped, and tortured Israelis and took hundreds hostage. So the Israelis are like, we're not into deterrence by denial anymore. We're into deterrence by punishment. Given the neighborhood we live in, we don't live in the Midwest, we live in the Mideast. And, you know, it's not Justin Trudeau's Canada that is our main enemy. It's Ali Khamenei's Islamic Republic. So they decided to strike back. And those are the strikes that we saw, which, by the way, we should talk about the strikes. I'm of the view that they weren't small. though they were limited, I thought they were symbolically quite profound.
I'm curious your thoughts on that response. Before we do that, though, I'm also curious what you make of Iran's attack, because it was a failure. Obviously, Israel's Iron Dome is a success, and it's telling that not just the West helped, but also other Arab countries helped stave off Iran there. But does that show a sign of weakness, that Iran is not as strong as we thought they are? Or did Iran kind of plan on this failing? Because we know that there were intelligence leaks where Israel was kind of preparing for an attack. They knew this was going to happen. And what are we to make of that failure?
Yeah, so I don't believe the I don't believe the Supreme Leader sends 321 cruise ballistic missiles and drones to fail. I think he was actually quite surprised by the sophistication of Israel's air defense system. In this case, it wasn't actually the Iron Dome shooting down these missiles. It was the Arrow and the David Sling, which deal with, medium and long range missiles and are quite extraordinary. And we've really never seen Arrow and David Sling operate in this manner. So I think it was quite a it was quite a test case for everybody. Supreme Leader wanted to kill Israelis, and it was only through the sheer, again, technological wizardry of what Israel has created, and again, assistance, very important assistance from the United States and our other allies, that was defeated. I mean, he meant to kill Israelis, kill civilians. He targeted Israeli air bases. He went after, I mean, I think he tried to go after Israel's nuclear reactor. That could have caused devastating damage. And indeed, I mean, there was one poor 7-year-old Israeli Muslim Bedouin girl who sustained severe head injuries and I believe is still in hospital. But that was one Israeli girl, one Israeli kid sustaining severe injuries. If those missiles and rockets and drones had gotten through, God forbid, there could have been hundreds, if not thousands, of Israeli kids, either in hospital or, God forbid, dead. So the Supreme Leader wanted to kill, and he wanted to inflict severe damage. It was a failure for him. But the fact that it was a failure doesn't mean that it wasn't a success, at least strategically, because he set a new normal, as I described earlier. He's made it clear, and certainly the regime made it clear: we, if you attack us in any way, we will unleash our might on you directly from Iranian soil, and you will face a multi-front war, a ring of fire that extends all the way to Iran, and you're going to have to contend with, hundreds of thousands of missiles and rockets and drones attacking this tiny country the size of, I think Lake Ontario or New Jersey, depending on your geographical comparison.
Nice Canadian shout out.
Yeah, exactly.
So that segues into the response. Prior to the response, there was a recent survey done from Hebrew University in Jerusalem where they said 52% of Israelis believed Israel should not respond. 48% argued that Israel should respond, even if it means extending the current round of conflict. 74% of Israelis opposed counterattack if it undermined Israel's security alliance with its alliance. So, pretty split amongst Israelis. On the one hand, Biden said, "You got to win, take a win," to Netanyahu. That's kind of, he was urging restraint, saying, "Listen, they did fail, so let's just leave it as that. We don't want this escalating. Let's get back into sort of Cold War mentality." But a lot of people felt that they also had to respond, and they ultimately did respond. And I belittled the response at the very beginning by saying it was a small response, but you said it was perhaps a greater, more significant response than I was giving credence to. What do you think the right call was here? Because it's tough. You don't want, obviously, to be extending and propagating this war in an already tenuous period. On the same token, how do you encounter that kind of attack and not respond and show your strength?
So Israel made the right decision by responding. I think that, as I said, deterrence by denial is a losing strategy. In the Middle East, it's deterrence by punishment. I mean, Israel's real predicament, and it's unique to Israel. It's the only democracy in the world that I think exists in a split screen. On one hand, it is a Western democracy, a liberal democracy facing the West. Obviously, Israelis, love America, they love Canada. And I believe Israelis and Poles are the two most pro-American countries on earth, much more pro-American than Canadians, by the way, in research polls. But you and I know that, having grown up in Toronto. But it's very interesting. So they're very pro-American, and they want to be part of the West. And being part of the West means, besides, commitment to democracy and liberal values, It also means when you are attacked, you defend yourself. I mean, I saw the German foreign minister said Israel's got a right to defend itself, but it doesn't have a right to counterattack under international law, which I thought was a really interesting interpretation of international law, which is basically you can like defend yourself if you're getting punched in the face, but you can't counterpunch against your enemy, which is just extraordinary. So, but yes, I mean, that is sort of the prevailing like Western view post-World War II. And force needs to be, quote, proportionate and not disproportionate. And that is why Israel has been roundly condemned since October 7th for its response to the Hamas terror attacks as it has moved into Gaza to try and destroy this Hamas terror infrastructure, where Hamas has so successfully used civilians as human shields, where the Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry has wildly exaggerated casualties. And Israel has been under, you know, withering criticism from many of its allies in the West. Well, that's the Western split screen. Problem is, when you live in the Mideast, as I say, not the Midwest, you live in a neighborhood where weakness is a sign of provocation. And so there, Israel has to actually use disproportionate force. It has to demonstrate to its enemies that if you hurt Israelis, then Israel will hurt you back many times over. And Israel cannot afford, you know, again, the niceties of being a Western democracy where your neighbor is Canada, or your neighbor is, in the case of the UK, Scotland, or even the Germans, who these days have very nice neighbors. They were not a nice neighbor for many, many centuries. But, you know, it's a fairly peaceful place, though I think the Europeans are really waking up to the reality of what it means to have Vladimir Putin on your eastern front, and seeing the devastation that Putin has wrought on Ukraine. So they may start waking up from their slumber to realize what life is like in the real world. But the Israelis in the Middle East are going to have to respond. Okay, so with that as context, because I think it's important to understand, again, the unique predicament that Israel finds itself in as a child of the East and a child of the West, the response had to be symbolically profound, but materially limited, because Joe Biden, as you said, had said, take a win and don't, right? This is the Biden don't doctrine. He had prior said to Iran, don't attack. Iran had attacked, as we discussed. And he said to the Israelis, don't counterattack. And so the Israelis had to be careful because, as that poll demonstrates, Israelis, they value the U.S. alliance, and they don't want to get into a major confrontation with a U.S. president. So they did counterattack, but in a limited way. But I would say in a limited way that was really interesting. Okay, let's explore the response. So Iran, as I said, tried to attack a Israeli Air Force base called Nevatim, where the squadron of F-35s are parked. They failed. The air defenses worked. So Israel basically turned around and used its fighter jets to fire a small number, not 321, but maybe a couple of dozen of precision-guided, you know, glider missiles at a Iranian Air Force base. It actually succeeded. It evaded Iranian air defenses, which didn't work, including an air defense system called the S-300 that the Iranians bought for a lot of money from the Russians, which is considered one of the most sophisticated air defense systems in the world. The Israelis, and I don't believe this has been reported, but the Israelis destroyed one of the radars of the S-300. So it didn't work, and they were able to penetrate the air defense system and hit the Iranian Air Force base. So Israeli air defenses work great. Iranian air defenses don't work so great, right? Israel can strike Iranian air bases at will. Seems like the Iranians can't strike Israeli air bases at will. And then it was very symbolic that they chose the Isfahan Air Force Base, which is co-located with the Isfahan International Airport, because Isfahan is the site of a major Iranian nuclear facility. And that facility is an important component of Iran's nuclear weapons program. It's also 120 kilometers away from Natanz. I mentioned it a couple times, where Iran's main, one of their two main enrichment facilities is. So the message to Iran was simple. We can hit you from anywhere, We can hit you hard with a small number of precision-guided munitions. We can penetrate your air defenses. We can hit your air bases. And by the way, we didn't do it this time, but next time around, maybe we'll hit your nuclear facilities. And the message to Khamenei needs to be, you know what? Your leadership assets, your military assets, your nuclear assets, your economic assets could be destroyed by Israeli firepower if you continue to escalate and threaten our people.
That's fascinating. So this counterattack was efficient and very effective, a meaningful and symbolic target, as you say, and also perhaps, I mean, it's only a day fresh, but it doesn't seem like the world has gone into complete alarm over the Israeli response either. It doesn't seem as if the world is completely up in arms over the fact that Israel counterattacked.
Not at all. In fact, I mean, well, let's start with the Iranians, because that would be the fear that the Iranians would then now retaliate and escalate, and this would lead to regional war and World War III, and that, you know, that is what the Biden administration lives in fear of, and that's why they are very deferential to Iran and not willing to use elements of American power to push back the Islamic Republic. But it's the reaction of the Islamic Republic that was most interesting, right? The regime actually said nothing happened. There were four quadcopters that we detected. We shot them down. We didn't need to activate our air defense system. There was no damage to our air base. And all of this was pretty lame. So they sent out their spokespeople, and they were, you know, driving around Isfahan to show no damage, nothing happened, and was an attempt to stand down. So they stood down. You know, the pearl clutches of the State Department and White House felt better. And all of a sudden, you know, the day has passed. Now, the weekend may bring new events. And certainly I absolutely expect that this will continue between Iran and Israel for the weeks and months and years to come. But this latest round, I think, was very adeptly handled by the Israelis. They managed to symbolically counterpunch, I think, frighten the Iranians when they now see Israeli capabilities, but do so in a way that didn't escalate and didn't create any friction with the Biden administration, which, by the way, had been alerted prior to the Israeli attack and certainly didn't object to it, if maybe they may have even approved it. So I think Israel comes out having had a pretty good week.
Mark, the last question I want to ask you is, you said you expect this to continue, which is no surprise. And as it does continue, and this is a really hard question, I don't expect you to have a crystal ball, but the only nuclear weapon that's ever been dropped was in 1945. And that was then followed by the Cold War. Many of us watched the movie Oppenheimer, and I'm currently reading the book American Prometheus, which is about that situation. And there's a really good Netflix documentary about the Cold War. And it talks about how one of the reasons the Cold War remained a Cold War was precisely because the stakes were so high after the two bombs were dropped in Japan. Neither the US nor the USSR wanted it to escalate. So that's why they were fighting via these proxies, and they never actually attacked each other, and it stayed as a Cold War. The reason I bring that up is because, in a sense, there has been a Cold War of sorts, which maybe has been broken because Iran actually did attack Israel directly. Would Iran or anybody be crazy enough to actually use an atomic bomb, a hydrogen bomb, at this point, knowing, especially Iran, knowing that if they did that, they would just be attacked right back? How strong is that narrative or that belief that because we know that it exists, it can't really be used? Because if one side uses it, the other side will use it. And is that enough to give us some security in our minds, some peace of mind that Iran wouldn't do this, or not really?
So, great question. You know, complicated answer. I want to address it in two scenarios. Scenario one is Iran would use it. Now, I hearken back to former president of Iran, Rafsanjani, who was considered by the smart set in Washington and Europe to be a pragmatist, even a moderate. And Rafsanjani, who, by the way, invested, you know, his extreme wealth that he had stolen in Toronto real estate for many, many years, still much of it is there. He was famously quoted as saying that Israel's a one bomb country. And, you know, Iran, we have 80 million people. There are over a billion Muslims. We should be prepared to lose tens of millions of Iranians and Muslims in order to destroy the Zionist entity, this cancerous tumor, as the supreme leader of Iran has called it. So again, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, this whole notion of mirror imaging, right? This idea that we have values and priorities. We love life, right? We don't welcome death, and we certainly don't celebrate death. And yet there is a, there are people around the world who are, you know, radical Islamists. I mean, but you know, you could go back earlier. I mean, Japanese kamikaze pilots, right? I mean, there is a certain like death cult. Nazi ideology had elements of this, where there is a sense of that we celebrate death. And certainly for religious Muslims who subscribe to this, there is an afterlife that will be better than this. And we welcome the afterlife, and we will commit jihad in order to enjoy the benefits of the afterlife. And it's suicidal and it's homicidal. And so I don't want to discount the possibility that the Islamic Republic, under certain conditions, would use atomic weapons to destroy Israel, even if it meant that there, and Israel has a second strike capability, even if it meant that, you know, millions of Iranians and or millions of Muslims in the Arab world in the Middle East would also be killed. That's one scenario. We must never discount that. And I think the Israelis after October 7th and what happened with Hamas and the brutality and the torture and you know, more Jews being killed on that day than at any time since the Holocaust. I don't think Israelis have any delusions about their enemies. I don't think they mirror image in the same way we do. And I think as Jews, with their experience with the Nazism, with anti-Semitism, homicidal anti-Semitism for generations, I think Israelis really believe that when your enemy says they want to kill you, take them seriously. Okay, but let's put that aside. I mean, that's pretty dark stuff, right? And your listeners could say, all right, Mark, but you know, what is the percent chance that's going to happen? And I can't tell you. Is it 1%, 5%, 10%? But I think it's something that needs to be acknowledged as a possibility. But here's a probability. We've talked about North Korea, we've talked about Ukraine. I believe that the Supreme Leader of Iran has a strategy. It's a very smart strategy. It's a long-term strategy, but he wants to turn Tel Aviv into Seoul, and he wants to turn Tel Aviv into Kyiv. And let me sort of just quickly walk through that. Today, I've been to South Korea, I've been to the DMZ, I've stood there and looked into North Korea, and just over the hills, one must recognize, though one doesn't see it, that there is a massive conventional weapons arsenal that the North Koreans have. And the US and South Korean militaries assess that with that conventional military, conventional arsenal, they could destroy Seoul in a matter of a couple of weeks. And just through the conventional arsenal, that has severely limited the American and South Korean military option. And you'll hear American military leaders and certainly political leaders say, we don't have a military option against North Korea. And that's just because of their conventional weaponry. Never mind the fact that they're a nuclear weapons power with long-range ballistic missiles on their way to ICBMs. Okay? So the fact that North Korea could destroy Seoul means that the militaries of the United States and South Korea and certainly Japan have no real military option against North Korea. And that's why the North Koreans are able to blackmail so effectively. So if the IDF would be similarly limited because there was such a massive conventional arsenal around it, this ring of fire that Khamenei has been building, you know, that's going to limit their ability to act against these proxies, because then they face a multi-front war with hundreds of thousands of missiles and rockets and mortars and anti-tank missiles raining down on their civilian population, and it limits the flexibility and capabilities of the IDF. Now, I'm only talking with conventional arsenals. Introduce the nuclear weapon into that. And imagine that October 7th happens under an Iranian nuclear umbrella, and Israel decides that they're going to go into Gaza, and the Iranians threaten nuclear escalation. Now you say, well, threat nuclear escalation. Well, who would ever do that? I don't know. Vladimir Putin just did it in Ukraine. over the past couple of years. And he's done it in such an effective way that he has frightened the Americans and the Europeans, which is why we haven't provided the Ukrainians with the kind of weapon systems they need to really take the fight to the Russians inside Russia. And I'm talking about long-range missiles and fighter jets and the kinds of things that really would have given the Ukrainians a real fighting chance. But we're terrified about Vladimir Putin's threats of nuclear escalation. I'll take you back even further, 1973, right? The Israelis in the Yom Kippur War, you know, a brutal first few weeks where it looks like Israel is losing. Israel turns this around, and they're within a couple of, you know, within a couple of miles of Cairo and Damascus. They've surrounded the Egyptian Second Army or Third Army, I can't remember which one it was, and they are like marching towards these two Arab capitals and about to demolish the most important army of the Egyptian military. And the Russians, the Soviets, threaten nuclear escalation, right? Threaten to go to like DEFCON 5 on this. And the Americans, the Nixon administration and Kissinger, and you see this in the movie Golda, right? Lean heavily on the Israelis to back down, and the Israelis eventually back down. Now, Iran threatens nuclear escalation after October 7th. Joe Biden lets the Israelis go into Gaza, or he backs down? I think without a doubt he backs down. I think any US president backs down, Democratic or Republican. And so by having the threat of nuclear escalation, never mind the conventional firepower, an Israeli prime minister and the Israeli military now may be out of options. And that, by the way, is Khamenei's vision, right? His vision is, I am going to fight a war of attrition against the Jewish state. I'm going to make it intolerable for Jews to live there. By the way, he says these Jews, they're not indigenous. They don't really have a commitment to the land and to the history of the country. They're all foreign implants with, you know, second passports, and they're all going to get out of Dodge and go live in Canada or the United States or return back to Europe where they belong. And he believes that. I mean, he fundamentally believes that. So he believes that he can wear down the Jewish state, drive as many Israelis as possible out of the country. The few that remain are going to be overwhelmed, and then he can effectively destroy the Jewish state. And he looks at Putin and what Putin is doing to Ukraine, and he says, yes, I can turn Tel Aviv into Seoul, and I can turn Tel Aviv into Kyiv, because at some point I can do so much damage to Tel Aviv and to the surrounding cities that it'll be intolerable to live in this tiny country. Now, that's a long answer to a very complicated question. And what I would say in sum is, I believe that there is absolutely a possibility the Iranians will use nuclear weapons to destroy Israel, a la Rafsanjani. I also am absolutely convinced that the Supreme Leader has a strategy where the mere threat of nuclear escalation, never mind conventional escalation, is designed to squeeze Israel, make it an intolerable place to live, drive out as many Israelis as possible, and then come in and destroy the Jewish state once and for all. So it is absolutely essential that Israel and the United States stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, because this Islamic regime, which is currently genocidal and brutally repressive and homicidally aggressive, will be even more dangerous if it has the worst weapons in its hands.
Well, it was a long answer, but it was a fantastic answer and really interesting perspective. I love how you've commented a couple times on that idea of mirror imaging, and you really can't because there's such a chasm in ideologies. And in addition, that point that it's not just about the nuclear bomb, it's the threat of the nuclear bomb and that escalation, and that will play out and lead to differing levels of support of Israel, because if you support too much, well, you got to watch out because there's that lingering threat of the bomb. And you can't really minimize the threat of that bomb when the consequences of it are unimaginably catastrophic. Mark, thank you so much for spending this much time with me. I could talk with you about the details of this for so long. There's so many dimensions to this, but I think this chat's really given people a perspective on Iran as a country, where it's coming from, why it hates the West so much ideologically, what it's capable of, what the state is of its nuclear weapons program, and how its recent attack on Israel is significant for many reasons, and how the world does need to respond to that, and not just, I forget the phrase you used that's often used in the Middle East, not just respond by denial. What was that?
By punishment. But Zell, I want to say one thing. I want to end where we started, and I think it's certainly relevant. You know, I'm from Toronto. You live in Toronto. As I said, an amazing Iranian community there. The only solution to this problem, we've talked about everything but this, is that the United States, Canada, Europe, Israel needs to provide maximum support to the Iranian people, not just maximum pressure on the regime. We need to support the millions of Iranians who take to the streets, who take to the streets every week, by the way. I mean, we have a protest tracker at my think tank. I mean, their protests have been 6,300 protests since the regime brutally killed Mahsa Amini that led to the Woman Life Freedom protest. Those protests happen every week. The majority of Iranians are pro-American, pro-Canada, pro-Israel, and all they want to do is live a decent life. They actually, you know, they share our values. They share our aspirations, and they want to live a life of freedom and prosperity and security. And they take to the streets, and we have not done nothing to support them. So take a page from Ronald Reagan, who supported the anti-Soviet dissidents in Poland and Czechoslovakia and throughout the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain, and helped embolden those people. And they were instrumental in helping bring down the Soviet Union. That's what we need to do. And we need to do that forthwith, because that's the only solution, is to bring down the Islamic Republic and replace it with something better.
Yeah, and it's so much has transpired over the past couple of years that it's easy to forget that Woman Life Freedom protest was just in 2022, so not long ago, and that was garnering a lot of world attention at the time. Mark Dubowitz, thank you so much for joining me. I know you have been discussing this ad nauseum with people who actually can impact change. And so I cannot impact change, but I'm glad that I have somebody like you to disseminate this knowledge and insight to people. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Zell. Really kind of you to have me on.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. You can find Mark Dubowitz's work. Just Google him online and you'll find a bunch of articles. Have a great day.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.